This is Jeff Spittler, February 13th, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 13. This episode is entitled The Two Kingdoms Come to Blows, Part 2. Okay, well, last time, which was 2 weeks ago, Brother Reese and I were enjoying someone else's teaching last week in the Dallas area. But last week we discussed Mary's sort of troublesome reign, specifically, among other things, the fact that there were a number of things that she was doing that was indicating the basic trend of her policy was to restore Catholicism. And she had yet another one of these interviews with Knox because he had spoke of her marriage in a sermon and she wasn't very happy about it. And let's see, I'm trying to remember if we got to the point where Darnley and Mary had been married, but no, we'll get to that today. But Moray had left the country, seeing the trend, the writing on the wall, and having had this sort of military non-encounter called the Chaseabout Raid. Okay, Mary is probably, I don't know, she's probably one of the most written about sovereigns of Scotland. And to this day, there are many people who are extremely sympathetic with her. And in fact, I found this quote while I was reading a fairly modern biography by Antonia Fraser. She said, we just come up to this point near this Parliament, and she says, "And what plans, if any, Mary had for helping the Catholics at the forthcoming Parliament will never be known. At most, she would probably have asked for toleration of the Mass for Scottish Catholics, rather than the rabid attacks to which the Mass and priests were subjected when detected. Mary was certainly modern enough in thought to wonder why the Catholics should not enjoy the free practice of their own religion, which she had so unquestioningly granted to the Protestants from the first moment of her arrival in Scotland. But of course Knox, like all those who have accomplished a revolution, was hysterically fearful to see its effects undone, and any ideas of mutual tolerance would have fallen on very deaf ears indeed." Now, if I've ever seen an example of somebody sort of casting modern worldview back onto somebody in the 16th century, you know, here it is. You know, for some reason, the biographer conveniently leaves out that the state of Scotland, you know, immediately before Mary's arrival, as all these people were killing each other, and the Catholics had martyred a number of Protestants, and yet she thinks that Mary would just, you know, want toleration. Can't we all just get along? So, and not to mention, of course, that Mary had been Queen of France when they were busy executing lots of Protestants, lots and lots of Huguenots. So, although I went back actually because I was kind of curious what she said about that, and she claims that she thinks Mary probably didn't actually witness these martyrs. Martyrs, but the martyring process. Even though, you know, at one time they were at a castle where they supposedly hung the Huguenots outside the windows and burned them so that they could, you know, enjoy the spectacle. But maybe she didn't see it. I don't know. Okay, so after Moray left, Mary continued her plan of, in my view, overthrowing the Reformation. She wrote a letter to the Pope on the end of January 1544, telling him that the time was right to strike at Scottish Protestantism. And Randolph, the English ambassador, wrote that popery was flourishing and that royal pressure was being applied by the nobility to attend Mass. So she had actually ejected him from the country later that month. Which probably signified that she was no longer concerned with whether or not she could come to terms with Elizabeth. And that's presumably because she would look to Catholics on the continent to help her achieve her goal of the English throne rather than trying to somehow negotiate it with Elizabeth for the succession. Okay, and then she planned for a Parliament in March, and which apparently the point of which would be to place Catholicism on an equal footing with Protestantism. And this is this quote that I read earlier is the one that said they never know what would happen. Okay, so basically after she scheduled this parliament for March, but after marrying Darnley, other problems, I would say, of her own making overtook her before the parliament could deal with any substantive issues. She, after marrying Darnley, she was made to be very sorry, and I couldn't help but think about some parallels to her own current political situation. Wondered if Hillary will ever feel as sorry as Mary did. But shortly after they were married, they began to quarrel frequently. Darnley began to drink heavily, and he used to slip out of the castle to visit brothels. His father, the Earl of Lennox, kept pushing him to obtain the crown matrimonial. Right, Mary wouldn't agree, and this was sort of a further friction and pressure between them. The crown matrimonial would mean that essentially if Mary died, he would be king, and if they died without issuing any heirs, that could resort to the Lennox family. So it's a difference between being the sort of like Mary was when she was Queen Dowager of France. She didn't really have any official position beyond that. So Mary couldn't marry someone else and still make that person King of France. She was just went back to Scotland. So, okay, Darnley became increasingly estranged, and that just increased his carousing. And he was gradually pushed out of the business of ruling, or rather, he allowed himself to be pushed out of it. He complained about having to sign all these papers that he had neither written nor read, and so they had a stamp made with his name on it. So, and the stamp went to Mary's French secretary, Riccio. And Darnley, meanwhile, just spent more time hunting, gambling, and carousing. He may have even believed rumors, or he probably believed rumors, that Riccio and Mary were lovers. And I can't remember how much I've talked about Riccio before. He was he had come over, I think it was French, but maybe it was Italian, with some ambassador, and Mary had taken a liking to him, and he could sing bass. He was an older man, but apparently she enjoyed his company quite a bit, and so she kept him on as a servant. And he, he grew increasingly powerful and arrogant. So the Protestant lords, starting to see the drift of Mary's machinations to overthrow the Reformation, that is, the remaining ones, the ones that hadn't fled the country, they saw that Riccio, she definitely had the queen's ear. He acted very arrogantly, and this fostered a deep resentment by the nobility. And along with Darnley's disenchantment with Mary, these attitudes eventually, they led to a plot against Riccio. And to this day, exactly what happened in every respect is unknown. But what is thought to have happened is that some of these Protestant nobles, and we use the term here Protestant loosely, but persuaded Darnley, or perhaps Darnley persuaded himself, that Riccio was what was standing between him and the queen and between him and the crown matrimonial. They may have also persuaded him that that Riccio was Mary's lover. Not really sure. But late on the ninth of March in 1566, Riccio and the Queen and several other companions were holding a small supper party in the private rooms of Holyrood House, and Darnley suddenly appeared to the surprise of the Queen. And a few minutes later, Lord Ruthven appeared, and he was wearing a steel helmet and armor. And he was followed by several other nobles, and in fact, they had the castle ringed with 500 men. Ruthven demanded that Riccio be handed over to them, saying he had been overlong in the queen's privy chamber. And she refused, saying, he was here by her own invitation. And Aristia also clung to the queen's skirts, but they dragged him off. And whether or not the first dagger wound was struck in Mary's presence was later a debatable issue. She thought that it was, always believed that it was. And she also thought that the violence that was done in her presence was aimed at her. I mean, she was 6 or 7 months pregnant now, and carrying King James, the future King James, and thought that perhaps this, the idea would be that she could, would miscarry or something. And her health was never really good. So, in any case, we don't know who stuck the first dagger into Riccio. It's thought to have been Darnley, but it may have been someone else. And whether or not they originally planned to execute him on the spot, that's also unknown. Some people think that the plan was basically that they would haul him off and have some kind of trial and then kill him judiciously. But in any case, once they stuck the first dagger into him, then he was dead by the time he hit the floor of the courtyard with a number of dagger wounds. So, Mike, what were you worried about today? Whether or not we'd get to overthrowing idols? Here we go. They just stabbed this guy to death. Okay, so all these things are known. Mary was terribly upset by all this, as you can imagine. But the other questions include, we don't know to what extent Moray knew and approved of this. He was in England at the time. But he had signed a bond with the conspirators. The terms of this bond included that Darnley would receive the crown matrimonial, okay, Darnley would protect Protestantism, and Moray would be pardoned, right? And Darnley signed this bond, and if you keep in mind, what led to a lot of the friction was the fact that she was marrying Darnley, a Catholic, and he was still a Catholic, but he had he'd become so frustrated with the situation that he was willing to go to extreme measures, and this was quite extreme. And I think basically the plan was is that they would set him up as king, and that they would keep Mary taking care of her baby, and and so on. But the bond didn't. I mean, it certainly didn't mention stabbing Darnley to death, or stabbing Riccio to death. Sorry, and. So I really don't know, but once the deed was done, Moray returned to Scotland immediately. And the other question is about John Knox. There's some question as to whether or not he knew about it in advance. A lot of people apparently knew of the general plan. After the fact, he approved of the deed, or at least he didn't repudiate it. Okay, he made some comment about it, but he didn't repudiate the deed. At this point, there aren't any sort of mitigating factors that are obvious, except for that perhaps he felt no need to comment on what had happened. I don't know what else. What else to tell you about John Knox and this event? He did. I mean, I don't think there's any evidence that he definitely knew about it or that he approved of it, but it's thought that he did. I guess, and if he did, then you could ask yourself, well, was it right for him to have done so? Which, well, if you want to talk about that, we'll save it for the discussion time. So, okay. Right, the planned outcome, presumably, of this is that they were going to set up Darnley, Henry Stuart, as the king. And, Rob.
Going to the general discussion that could follow, what exactly did they catch Riccio doing?
What exactly did they catch him doing?
Slumber party going on.
It was a supper party. They were playing cards. There was four or five people present. But they didn't actually catch him doing anything that in the event that would justify killing him on the spot. No, it was more of a I guess this is the issue. I don't know that he was guilty of any specific crime that would have been capital in nature. I mean, he was certainly extremely arrogant, very dislikable. He was certainly furthering Mary's pro-Catholic policy. He was, I don't know. There are several things. I mean, you have to remember, of course, this is in an age, certainly in Scotland, when murder was a likely means of avenging perceived wrongs. And particularly, I guess this had been common for sort of low-born advisors to kings and queens. But I'm not excusing, I'm just saying that basically, as far as I can tell, there's nothing that would really justify this specific course of action.
Except for perhaps conspiracy.
But basically a political sort of consideration, not something we could identify clearly as a capital crime or anything like that. You might well make the argument that you could have just as well tied the guy up and sent him off on a boat back to France, and that would have achieved their objective. But I think there was more to it than that. They were planning on overthrowing Mary, too. I mean, that's really... It's still hard to understand today, and this is still one of the famous events of Scottish history, is this murder. Even today, if you read any of the biographers of Mary or Moray or so on, they have different opinions on what happened and why. So, anyways.
Well, could Darnley have been at it for a personal motivation?
Could Darnley have been at it for a personal motivation? Absolutely. I think that's what the nobles were playing at. This, for Darnley, I'm sure it was quite personal.
It may have been avenging adultery.
Well, he may have thought that, yeah. But, that is possible, but it seems unlikely at this point, so. Yeah. So the eventual outcome of this was, in a sense, favorable to the Protestant cause. But that the outcome was as planned is impossible to believe, as we'll see it unfold. It's also thought that these guys planned to capture and kill the Earl of Bothwell and Earl of Huntly, two of Mary's loyal supporters. But in the event, they escaped. And Mary later claimed that the plan had been to put her in prison or house arrest in the Castle of Stirling, where she'd would have nursed her baby and so on. So they shut Mary up in one of the chambers, and the king went in to see her. After she upbraided him some... She kind of came to her senses, and Mary was nothing if not a supreme manipulator. She certainly hated Darnley at that moment. I mean, she'd hated him before, and now he came in and killed her servant. So she dissembled, lied, acted as if she still loved him, and she persuaded him to help her escape. Now, Darnley was definitely a fool. Because not only now he signed this bond with these other nobles. I mean, and these are not guys you mess around with, obviously. As just witnessed by their performance in with Riccio. And nevertheless, she persuaded him. He helped her escape a few days later. And I think he knew how dangerous it was to go back on his word. But in any case, he... 9 days later, she was able to march back into Edinburgh with 8,000 men at her side. And the Protestant lords, the remaining Protestant lords who hadn't fled the country after the Chasuble raid, the remaining ones had to flee now. And because at this point, they no longer had a claimant to the throne. So when Darnley was part of their conspiracy, they had somebody who they could sit on the throne and say, this is our man and he has a claim to the throne. But, once he'd gone over to the other side and they were kind of left, they didn't even have a pretender to use. So, but after she came back, she pardoned Moray and the other lords that had been involved in the previous Chasuble raids. And they had at least the virtue, such as it was, of not having been involved in Riccio's murder. Also, she needed the nobles to rule the country, so she was kind of left, I guess from her perspective, choosing between the lesser of two evils. But she never forgave Darnley, and this leads us on to the sort of series of events which lead to Mary's downfall. So, in the spirit of détente, if you will, she settled down with Darnley and awaited the birth of their child. On the 19th of June, 1566, a male son, an heir to the throne, was born, he was James the Sixth. Okay. He was later to become James the First of England when he, after Elizabeth's death, when he did accede to the throne. And he's the same King James as the King James Version of the Bible. By his defenders and partisans, you know, it's a sign of his love of literature and so on that he had the King James Bible translated. Those of us who know better know that he did it so that he could get rid of the Geneva version of the Bible, which had these notes that he didn't like. But after James's birth, relations between Mary and Darnley continued to decline. At one point, they were visiting a house on the Tweed called Traquair. And Mary demurred from going stag hunting because she thought she was pregnant again. And Darnley said the same thing he said when they were trying to escape from Holyrood House, which basically amounted to, "Don't worry, we can have more." So I'm sure you women in the class here will appreciate that that's not the kind of thing your husband ought to say if he wants to stay in your good graces. But I mean, he was definitely a fool and very immature. Okay, her health also declined. There was one point at which they thought she was very near to death, but she did recover. In fact, she lived some time after that. At the end of November 1566, she was approached by some of the nobles with a proposition, and I'll say some Protestant and other Catholic nobles were approached with this proposition. Moray was not involved in this. They would find means for her to divorce Darnley. She had pardoned the nobles involved in Riccio's murder, and she agreed basically on the condition that James's right to the throne wouldn't be impaired by this thing. I mean, apparently if she divorced him under some circumstances, James might be considered a bastard and therefore unfit to rule. Maitland, who's probably our supreme example of someone who has no particular principles, promised that it would be, whatever it was done would be approved by Parliament. Okay, one of the nobles was the Earl of Bothwell, who we've already mentioned. He's about 30 at the time. And if you probably won't remember this, but where have we heard of him before? When the Protestants were receiving money from Elizabeth in 1559, he caught one of the couriers and stole £3,000 from him. But he had been loyal to Mary through her recent traumas, the chase about raids and the murder of Riccio. And at some point, and we don't know when, not exactly, but the relationship between Mary and Bothwell became more than that of queen and servant. And according to Mary's supporters today, they'll say very little about it. But in fact, this after Mary... after she ended up abdicating, there was a trial. These so-called casket letters were produced, and among them were letters back and forth between Darnley and Mary, between Bothwell and Mary, which you would, I guess, call love letters. And there's some question about whether or not some of them were forged, and so the whole thing is a bit murky. But apparently, at some point, certainly they got married later on. But in any case, that's just a sort of a side issue at this point. Let's see, 17th of December, she had James baptized in full Catholic form, and there was this grand party held with many notable guests. But one person that was obviously missing was the baby's father, and he slipped out of the castle a week later and went to his father's house in Glasgow. And the reason for his absence at the baptism became obvious. He was suffering from what was apparently syphilis. And in this phase, it was he had this pock marks. It was very disfiguring. And so he slipped out. He went to his father's house, which was in Glasgow. And a week later, she did pardon Riccio's murderers. And one of them, the Earl of Morton, was met by Bothwell at the border, and years later he wrote that Bothwell told him at that point that they had to kill the king. Probably true. No one disputes that Bothwell, I mean, Mary's supporters and detractors all believed that Bothwell was the sort of chief person, very clearly, who killed the king. In any case, there was a plot being formed to kill the king at this point. And Mary, there were also rumors that Darnley was getting better. In fact, there was a lot of wild rumors going around that he had various sorts of plans for either deposing Mary or other sort of wild activities, traveling to Europe and telling everybody the story of Mary. One was that he was going to inhabit the Isles of Scilly and use that as a base to raid England and take over the throne, Elizabeth's throne. In any case, these rumors were flying around, and on the 20th of January, 1567, Mary traveled to Glasgow, and she again used the same wiles that turned Darnley to her side previously and persuaded him to return to Edinburgh. Okay, while he was in Glasgow in his father's castle, he was probably relatively safe, but he went back to Edinburgh, and Mary first suggested one place for him to convalesce, and he turned that down, not feeling safe enough. Then she suggested a house called Kirkafield, which was by a church, St. Mary's in the Fields. It was near the city walls, and he was there for about 10 days. She visited him several times while he was convalescing. She even spent several nights under the same roof, although in a different bedroom. But on the night of Sunday, February 9th, she left the house to attend a wedding mask, a ball, and then went back to her Holyrood house. And about 2 a.m., there was a tremendous explosion in Edinburgh. The explosion was this house being blown up. It was blown up with gunpowder, and it was so tremendous force that the house was just reduced to rubble. Okay, Darnley's body was found outside, but interestingly enough, no noticeable injuries. What transpired was that he hadn't been killed by the explosion. He'd been strangled or suffocated. So there are all kinds of theories, and there are even books on this whole affair. As you can imagine, this is terribly convoluted. Mary, at some point, claimed to have thought that maybe this plot was aimed at her, which seems a bit far-fetched. I mean, it was timed exactly when the assassins knew that she was not in the house, because she'd gone off. She was reminded that one of her servants' weddings, and she was reminded that it was time to go to this wedding mask. So she was clearly out of the house. There's no question about that. Why was Darnley killed outside, or why was he suffocated? I mean, one theory is that he heard something going on, I read somewhere that it wasn't uncommon for your house to be burned over your head, if not blown up. And apparently hearing this, they figured out what was going on, or maybe what was going on, and fled the house, where he was caught by someone who then suffocated him. We won't spend a lot of time in our Sabbath school class discussing how this murder plot worked out, but it's very interesting. The sort of debatable questions are really who knew what and when did they know. And shortly thereafter, Elizabeth wrote a letter, which she included the following. This is a letter to Mary. "I cannot but tell you what all the world is thinking. Men say that instead of seizing the murderers, you are looking through your fingers while they escape, that you will not punish those who have done you so great a service." She concludes with, "I exhort, I advise, I implore you to lay your hands upon the man who has been guilty of the crime." Anonymous posters, which were a new innovation in Scotland, they'd come in Europe with the printing press. You know, you could generate a bunch of posters and sort of stick them up at night. Started to appear in the streets of Edinburgh. Some claimed that Bothwell and Sir James Balfour, who is the landlord of the Kirkafield house, he was a cousin and good friend of Bothwell, and he'd also recently purchased a large quantity of black powder. Those were the murderers, and Mary was an assenting party. And I think the posters hit the nail on the head. And this is quoting Otto Scott, who says, "One poster appeared that struck more deeply than any others, and copies of it were circulated throughout all Europe. It showed Mary, Queen of Scots, as a mermaid, the stereotype of a prostitute at that time, with naked breasts and a crown, lashing at pursuing hounds with a whip, while Bothwell, who was pictured as a hare, the crest of the Hepburns," he was His real name was Patrick Hepburn, Earl of Bothwell, crouched fearfully inside a circle of swords. The masses who could not read could grasp the significance of that illustration in a flash. So this very quickly became a very public sentiment in Edinburgh and so on. And furthermore, Mary's mourning wasn't very convincing. She wore black, but she was also observed playing golf and archery shortly thereafter. She granted Bothwell 3 additional castles, including the Castle of Edinburgh, where he forcibly removed the Earl of Mar from it. Bothwell's wife developed a sudden and mysterious illness, reputed to be by poison, but she survived it. And as Scott put it, Bothwell is now the de facto king of Scotland, and he was busy arranging things accordingly. Moray and a number of the other Protestants actually at that point fled the country. Moray applied for a passport to travel through England. He told Cecil that he feared for his life if he remained in Scotland, which would be from Bothwell sort of consolidating his power. On the 23rd of March, 1567, so this would have been about 6 weeks later, a high mass was held for Darnley. And this was at the end of the period of official mourning. And the Earl of Lennox, Darnley's father, was demanding a trial. And, he claimed that Bothwell had done this crime. So Mary and Bothwell decided to allow him to bring the case to trial. Right? This was a private prosecution, not a Queen's prosecution. And so he received an official notice to appear in Edinburgh with his charges and evidence. Right, we've already discussed that in Scotland at the time, some of these cases were decided on the basis of who had the most retainers or soldiers present with them. Lennox brought 3,000 men with him. Okay, Bothwell, who came from the Scottish borders, and he'd been a lieutenant there and involved in quite a few border skirmishes and so on, brought 4,000 men. And ostensibly to avoid a bloody confrontation, Mary informed Lennox that he could only bring 6 retainers. Okay, so 6 against 4,000 we could guess the outcome of that. And so Lennox gave up and he went to England knowing that justice would never be served. But on the 12th of April, Bothwell went to trial anyways, and since there were no accusers, not surprisingly, he was acquitted. So Bothwell publicized his acquittal with more posters, and he offered to meet any naysayers in private combat. Parliament met the following week, but most of the nobles were absent. A week later, at the end of the Parliament, what nobles were left, there were 28 nobles and prelates, and Bothwell invited them to this banquet at Ainslie's Tavern. Anyways, he presented them with a long document, the key points of which were he was innocent of the murder, and they would promote the marriage of him, Bothwell, to the Queen. Okay, so a number of them signed. The tavern was surrounded by Bothwell's, I like this term, hag butters. That was an ancient pistol, a matchlock pistol, so these guys carrying these ancient matchlock pistols were called hag butters. And he had a number of his men surrounding the tavern, and they acquiesced and signed off on this, although a number of them apparently just signed off knowing that they didn't have much choice and they were going to rectify things shortly. So Bothwell then proposed to the Queen. He showed her this bond, this document that they had signed, and Mary's supporters claimed that she turned him down at this point, but that later she acquiesced because she thought that, first of all, he'd been a strong supporter of hers, and second, this had the support of all the nobles. That's what he claims. Or that's what they claim, saying they weren't actually having an affair before this. I don't know. But anyways, a few days later, Mary was en route from having visited James, who was at the Castle of Stirling, and she was, quote, abducted by Bothwell. And this was even her... even her partisans say that using the word abduction is a bit strong. But in any case, he carried her off to Dunbar Castle, and where, in the words of one of her biographers, he decided to complete his formal abduction of her person by the physical possession of her body. So in other words, he supposedly raped her and put her in a position where she couldn't escape marrying him. He still had to get rid of his first wife, but on the 3rd of May, she obtained a judgment against him on the grounds of adultery with one Bessie Crawford, whoever that was. Not with Mary. I thought that would be very ironic if that was the case. And on the 7th of May, the marriage was formally annulled by the Catholic archbishop, so he was covering all his bases. He got, in a Protestant church court, a divorce granted, and then he had the marriage annulled. Because, in fact, under Catholic rule, if he was divorced, he couldn't be remarried. But if the marriage was annulled, then he could be remarried. And this Catholic archbishop, who actually had been appointed by Mary a few weeks before to the post, I didn't mention this, but she had appointed this bishop of St. Andrews or something like that just a few weeks ago. There hadn't been any Catholic appointments. She appoints this guy, and then a few weeks later, his marriage is annulled by the Catholic archbishop on the basis that they had not received a dispensation for the marriage, even though they were within the fourth degree of consanguinity, or in other words, they were fourth cousins. So, he had his marriage annulled, although interestingly, one of the things that came up later was that his wife was still living in the castle, and supposedly Bothwell had told her that she was his true wife and Mary was just a concubine. And we don't know if this is true, but the fact that Bothwell got a lot of money from marrying this woman in the first place probably meant that he didn't have much choice but to leave her in the castle, or else she might want it back. So, 15th of May, 1567, so we're now just a little over 3 months past when Darnley was blown up, she marries Bothwell. Okay, she marries in a Protestant ceremony, and this is, in order to be married in a Protestant ceremony, they had to have what's called banns published. In other words, formal notice of the marriage. The minister who was publishing the banns, not the one who married them, his name was John Craig, was the Knox's replacement in Edinburgh, and he objected on about six grounds. He objected on this. That Bothwell had been guilty of adultery, and that he had ravished the queen, and that he was suspected in the murder, and so on. Bothwell threatened to hang him. Basically, Craig wasn't saying anything that the rest of Edinburgh didn't believe already. So, public sentiment had pretty much been whipped to a fury by this time. Mary, even if she wasn't a conspirator in the murder, at this date, it's very hard to believe that she wasn't, because she did lure Darnley back to Edinburgh, right? And whatever else you may say, she did that. She then excused the murderer, Bothwell, and then married him. And even her, even her partisans today say this was, terribly imprudent thing to do. So, Bothwell continued to consolidate his power, and the rest of the nobility basically decided he had to be dealt with. And on the 6th of June, Maitland, right, who's this sort of chameleon-type guy, disappears from the court, and they hear that there's a force coming from towards Edinburgh. So Bothwell and Mary, they head for the Scottish borders, which is where Bothwell's homes are, where he could raise a large force, where his 4,000 men came from. They split up. Mary never reached the border. She started to gather a force to return to Edinburgh. She had 1,500 men. They met a much larger force at Carberry, which is 8 miles from Edinburgh. And the French ambassador came along with the rebels to parley, and he went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth between the two sides. And while he did this, Mary's soldiers slipped away. I mean, I guess they thought either A, they were fighting on the losing side, or B, they really given up on supporting her. So she was forced to surrender on the 15th of June, 1567. And this is a very good time to stop, since A, I'm out of notes, and B, it's time. We should have some time for some questions. So, but basically, let me tell you what's going to happen. She's going to surrender. Bothwell's going to disappear, never to be. Well, I wouldn't say never to be heard from again. He has the misfortune of landing in Denmark, where he had. How should I say this? Deceived. I guess it was a princess there, and had misused her severely, and he had the bad fortune to fall into her father's arms. So he never returns. He dies over there, and she's then forced to abdicate, and James VI is crowned king, and then we have, she does escape once. There's sort of two parties, if you will, the queen's party and the king's party. Now, the king is still an infant. The king's party are the Protestants who want to, to rule Scotland with a regent, as it turns out, there's still some fighting back and forth, but eventually she goes into English custody, but we'll maybe talk about that more next week. Questions? Discussion? Rob?
We may have thought of this before, but how does Moray or any other lords, how do they retain their power when they're gone? I mean, how can Mary leave the lords to rule?
Well, it was still it was somewhat of a feudal system. They have control of the land, and they can raise an army from among the men that till their land and so on. Now, exactly what the economic arrangements were, I'm not exactly sure, but it was essentially a feudal system, or still had that aspect where they could control large numbers of soldiers from the men who were on their land, and that's why and of course they owned some of the castles and controlled some of the castles. So when Bothwell kicked the Earl of Mar out of Edinburgh Castle, right up until that point, the Edinburgh Castle of Edinburgh, there, it's on very high ground, and you can shoot, cannons in every direction. You actually, if there's a military force that was coming into Edinburgh, you could, shoot cannon and grape shot at them. So,
was there a battle there, or
did he just left? He just left. I don't really know the details. He was forced out, and he left. But Mike,
what is the key to Edinburgh? What is that positive to everybody?
It was the capital of Scotland. It was the most populated city. What's that, Simon? It still is the capital of Scotland. Yeah, they haven't moved it anywhere. Well, some people might say the capital of Scotland is London, but so. Other questions? Okay, well, this is certainly, I don't know, I mean, this is kind of some of the most exciting sort of happenings. Not completely, there's very little of the sort of two kingdoms theme in today's lecture or lesson, but it's a very important part of history to sort of understand what happens next and how we get back to a Protestant regent in Scotland, which will happen shortly. So. Okay, well, thanks. And Simon, would you close?